Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
From the Society for Nautical Research, in partnership with Lloyd's Register Foundation, I'm Sam Willis, and this is the Mariner's Mirror podcast, the world's number one podcast dedicated to all of maritime history. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Mariner's Mirror podcast. It's time for a bit of underwater history. On the 24th of May 1945, the Supreme Commander of the German Navy, Admiral Karl Dönitz, recorded the following words in his war diary. Wolfpack operations against convoys in the North Atlantic, the main theatre of operations and at the same time the theatre in which air cover was strongest, were no longer possible. They could only be resumed if we succeeded in radically increasing the fighting power of the U-boats. That was the logical conclusion to which I came, and I accordingly withdrew the boats from the North Atlantic. We had lost the Battle of the Atlantic. To find out more about the U-boat's role in the Second World War, I spoke with Larry Patterson, who has written a new and importantly global history of the U-boat during the Second World War. Larry has developed a lifelong interest in U-boat history, inspired by both of his grandfathers, one of whom was an Anzac during the First World War, and the other a Royal Navy Stoker in the Second. He spent a period of time as a member of the Royal Navy Submarine Museum's Archive Working Group, specialising in U-boat records, and his work challenges the accepted historical narrative of the role of U-boats in the Second World War. As ever, I hope you enjoy listening to Larry as much as I enjoyed talking with him. Here is Larry. Larry, thank you very much indeed for joining me today.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for having me here.
I was just sitting downstairs reading your book, and my kids were in the room, and I asked them to suggest two questions about German U-boats that they wanted answered. From the world expert in German U-boats. They're slightly abstract, but very good. First question from my daughter, Beatrix Willis. She wants to know, what would happen if there was a murder on a U-boat?
If there was a murder on a U-boat? Wow. You know, I've never actually thought about that.
We don't know. Is there a safe area people could be locked away in?
Not really. I mean, there were always, you could lock them in the toilet, although if a U-boat was outbound, it only had one functioning toilet, so that wouldn't be any use. No, there's no brig as such or anything like that. Not on a combat U-boat anyway. So, no, you'd be in some trouble.
With a murderer. I think it's just because we've all watched Murder on the Nile.
There's
a bit of Agatha Christie and boats going on. And the second question from my son, which is a cracker, would you prefer to be on a U-boat with 50 versions of yourself or 50 versions of your worst enemy?
Oh, my God. That's a toughie. You know, I'd probably, narcissistic as it sounds, I'd have to say myself. There we go.
Yeah, that's what I think I'd
say. At least I'd know the answer to the arguments, you know.
however dangerous that would be. Brilliant. Well, there we are. So the podcast has been hijacked by my kids.
And, there we go.
We've got some good answers there. So let's talk about you and your interest in U-boats and what you've come to learn about the U-boat war and how that's changed perspectives. When did you first start becoming interested in the underwater world?
Well, I've been interested in the Second World War since I was a kid. Mainly, you know, I grew up in the countryside in New Zealand, and there were a lot of Second World War veterans there. One grandfather was in the Royal Navy in the Second World War. My other grandfather was in the Anzacs in the First World War. So it's sort of a topic that's always interested me, but it never really focused on U-boats per se until I lived in France in the late 90s. And I lived just outside of Brest, where the first U-boat flotilla and the 9th were based. And I'm a diving instructor, so I was doing a lot of diving on wrecks there. Not so much U-boat wrecks in Brest, but the ships that used to shepherd them in and out of harbour, and minesweepers and so on. And a friend of mine, an American author, John Gorn, who wrote a fantastic book about the Battle of Brittany, the Americans and the Germans, 1944, sent me a microfilm of the first U-boat flotilla war diary, handwritten war diary. And I had this old slide projector from my dad, and I shone it through there. And I just remember being, you know, absolutely fascinated by this document. And it kind of took off from there, really. And that was the genesis of my first book, which was the first U-boat flotilla. Just again, it's their war diary, really, and expanding on it. And since then, it's just kind of grown. You know, I've got an interest in World War II in general, the Wehrmacht as a whole, and it's sort of just almost by accident focused on the U-boats and the Kriegsmarine and so on. So.
Yeah. We should say, for those of you who don't know, that in Brest we have the wonderful U-boat pens.
Yes.
There's some fairly serious archaeology there which can inspire you to do U-boats. Well, tell us a little bit about the pens.
The pens are amazing. They're when the U-boats first used Brest Harbour, and there were several U-boat bases on the French Atlantic coast, which was a major advantage of the Germans having invaded France. So they established bases in Brest, Lorient, Saint-Nazaire, La Rochelle, and Bordeaux. And obviously, in the beginning in Brest and in all these harbours, the U-boats were just using the fishing ports or the naval port, whatever facilities were available. And a British bombing at that stage hadn't really sort of kicked off in a major fashion. But in Brest, it was also the home of the Admiral Hipper, called in there, and you had the Scharnhorst and the Gneisenau on the Atlantic coast, and they became targets for the Royal Air Force. So, you know, it was really obvious that they needed this sort of shelter. So they built these enormous U-boat pens, which are really incredible structures, and they're all still standing because they're just so big, you know.
Yeah, if there's something that actually is a manifestation of what a evil genius in a Bond film might be operating out of. It's like that. So there.
That's it.
Let's describe them. It's a huge concrete bomb-proof bunker open to the sea. Is that about fair?
Pretty much, yeah. Monolithic construction. I mean, just enormous. The one in Lorient's the most complex, actually a complex of three bunkers, one of which is open to the sea, and two of them were on land behind that one. And the U-boats used to be lifted up on a cradle and moved in and out of the maintenance bunkers on land. Absolutely fascinating sort of piece of, you know, engineering there, built by the organization Todt. And ironically, the British never took the opportunity to bomb it when it was under construction. They waited until it was constructed and then bombed it, and, you know, sort of destroyed the towns around it. And I think they put one hole in the Brest bunker, which was actually done by the 617 squadron, you know, the dam busters. And they dropped a tall boy on it, and it actually penetrated the roof of the bunker. And there's photographs of, once it had fallen to the Allies, troops standing next to this hole. And it's absolutely incredible. The same kind of construction that you saw in V2 bunkers near the Pas-de-Calais, you know. But this sort of idea, that those sort of bomb-proof bunkers had been built in the First World War, but not to this scale. And obviously they were on the English Channel at that point. So, yeah, really impressive, absolutely amazing. But the one in Brest is still in use by the French Navy. Yeah,
is it?
Yeah,
that's extraordinary. The fact that the British didn't bomb it seems a remarkable oversight. So obviously the British had learnt of the threat of U-boats from the First World War. So the Second World War, the Germans have U-boats. They're using them from earlier on in the war. They take France. That gives the them easy access to the Atlantic, therefore it changes everything. Why didn't they... What was going on? Why didn't they attack them?
It's a very good question. It was kind of a matter of priority of targets more than anything else, and it just wasn't felt to be that level of priority. They knew they were under construction, so it was it's a very unusual omission. I mean, yeah, Bomber Harris was he was a clever guy. You know, he wasn't an idiot or anything. So, what can I say? Yeah,
we don't know. Well, I mean, let's talk about the threat of the U-boats then, and kind of to a certain extent, learning from the past. At the outbreak of the Second World War, were the British expecting there to be a U-boat threat?
They were and they weren't. I mean, they got punished quite badly in the First World War in 1917, when Germany had always they'd sort of done limited. Sounds like a contradiction, limited unrestricted campaigns and always then shied away from it. In 1917, when they were facing sort of starvation in Germany and the backs were to the wall, they unleashed the unrestricted submarine campaign by which U-boats could sink ships without warning within whatever areas they prescribed to be a war zone. And it took a heavy toll in the First World War, but it was mastered by convoying. By gathering the ships together and putting an effective escort around it, it kind of robbed the U-boats the opportunity to inflict that crippling blow. So there was this mistaken belief that U-boats had actually been mastered by the time the Second World War came around, even though, you know, Churchill was quite sort of paranoid about, justifiably so paranoid about the U-boat threat. But I mean, Germany entered the war with only 57 U-boats, 57 combat U-boats, 30 of which were like Type 2 coastal boats. So it was sort of, it was perceived as a threat, but not the war-winning threat that it soon became known as. And also Britain had developed ASDIC, you know, effective sonar and all this kind of thing. And they felt that they, even though they ironically had actually ignored anti-submarine warfare to a certain degree in the interwar period anyway, but they were aware of the U-boat, so they weren't as worried as they perhaps should have been, I think it's fair to say.
It was interesting there what you said about just the coastal U-boats. There's obviously a danger when talking about U-boats to assume that you're talking about the same thing, that a U-boat was a U-boat. Can we just talk a little bit about the different designs of U-boats? How many different types were there at the start of the war?
At the start of the war, there were three. There were three types. A Type 2, which is a small, basically a coastal U-boat, which actually did make it into the Atlantic, but they could carry a very limited number of torpedoes. They had three torpedo tubes, a small crew, very uncomfortable on a long voyage. They were really designed for the North Sea. Then you had the Type 7, which was your medium-sized U-boat. And that's the one, that's the famous one. That's the backbone of the U-boat fleet, the one made famous in Dust Bowl and so on and so on. Designed for the Atlantic, first actually went into action in the Spanish Civil War, covertly. And ultimately carried the U-boat war. They ended up going as far afield as, you know, Freetown, West Africa, the Caribbean, places like that, with the help of refueling either by other U-boats or by refueling U-boats, which were developed later in the war. Then there was, at the beginning of the war, there was a Type 1, and that was the large U-boat, and that was entirely unsuccessful design. They only built two, and they just didn't handle well. They weren't very good. So that was swiftly replaced by the Type 9, which was in development as the war began, and that became your long-range U-boat. And that was the one that ranged to United States and the Gulf of Mexico, Caribbean, and ultimately made it as far as New Zealand.
Wow.
Yeah.
I did not know that.
There
tell
we
me
go.
About the tell me about the New Zealand one.
The New Zealand one was a type, what they call a Type 9D2. It was a long range boat. And there were a certain number of U-boats that were assigned to the Indian Ocean, not only to sort of attack British shipping, but they then moved on to Penang eventually and founded a U-boat station in the Far East, which kind of came on the back of this transport missions by U-boat to swap technology with the Japanese forces. Anyway, one of these boats, U-862, by a guy called Heinrich Timm, he wanted to make a point, and in 1944 he sailed into the Pacific, made it down to, you know, New Zealand, chased a ship off the coast of New Zealand and basically missed his opportunity to fire and sank one ship off Sydney, which was the only ship sunk by U-boat in the Pacific.
Interesting stuff. So we talk about these designs. The follow-up question is pretty obvious, but were they all the same at the end of the war?
How do you mean?
I mean, was there a significant design change and improvement in U-boats by the end of the war? Had the weapon fundamentally changed?
Yes and no. The combat U-boats that went into action, the bulk of them remained the same sort of boats that they entered the war with. Obviously with upgrades, various conning tower configurations, different flak weapons, an upgraded sort of technology, if you like, but essentially they were unchanged and they were obsolete. The Germans had in the meantime thrown a lot of effort into producing what's been known as the electro boats, because a classic Second World War stereotypical U-boat is not actually a submarine, it's more a submersible. They were designed to operate surfaced. They weren't actually designed to fight underwater. They were designed to be able to escape underwater if they needed to. But the most effective use of U-boats in the very early stages of the war by people, particularly like Otto Kretschmer and Eric Topp and people like that, the famous aces, they would stay on the surface where they had a good surface speed. They could outrun certain destroyers. They had a very low silhouette. And they were like torpedo carriers that would get in among, these guys would actually penetrate inside a convoy, open fire, and then escape at speed. Now, the idea of the electro boats was they had a massive battery capacity, which meant that they operated predominantly submerged, because by the latter stages of the war, U-boats were forced underwater. They couldn't operate surface because of Allied radar, which had completely misjudged its effectiveness and all this kind of thing. So they developed this electro boat technology where boats would basically remain submerged for much longer, capable of firing at greater depths, using more advanced, sophisticated weapon guidance systems, so on and so on. And it was a sort of a flawed project right from the word go because of the fractious nature of German industry under the Nazis. And the Type 21, the famous one, never really went into action. There were two war patrols with no effect. And the rest of them, some were sunk en route to Norway before they became operational. Some were sunk in training. Most were destroyed in shipyards. But there was a smaller version, a Type 23 electro boat. And it was actually one of those that fired the very last torpedo attack of World War II and sunk the last two ships of the war. But it was a small design. It was an effective submarine, but it carried two torpedoes. That was it, you know, no more than a midget submarine. So its effectiveness was never going to be that great. They were also originally, part of the idea of them was they were going to be transferred to the Mediterranean and used in the Mediterranean. By the time they became available, that war was already lost. So yes, it was a technological shift, but in the actual combat boats, it was a matter of patching up obsolete designs, really. And they were completely outmatched by the end of the war.
Was there a kind of a decent match between what the boats were capable of and the strategy for using them?
Yes and no. I mean, have you ever been on, there's a U-boat in Kiel, a Type 7 U-boat in Kiel. If you ever get a chance, you should visit it.
I have not, but I will put it on my list.
Oh, definitely. U-995. And you go on that and you go through there and, I don't know, there's four or five people with you and it feels crowded already. Now, when you consider that one of these things had, you know, up to 50 people aboard, the conditions for the crews were quite often horrendous, particularly later in the war when they were forced underwater to operate submerged using snorkels and so on. So they were asked to do things that it took quite a feat of endurance on behalf of the crews to be able to do so, if you like. But they, you know, to be fair, the crews rose to the challenge. I mean, one of, you know, This type of boat ended up going as far afield as the Caribbean. So, you know, that's quite something. People would come back and they'd be in a hell of a state when they came ashore. But yeah, it sort of, what they were asked to do by Carl Dönitz, they were capable of doing. aside from the fact that the technology wasn't really up to the job after, I would say, 1942. You know, radar had sort of defeated their surface possibility. Air power just absolutely hammered them. And from then on, or even earlier than then, the German technological advancements, they weren't leading the race. They were reacting to Allied advances, you know. Radar became a major problem, so they developed radar detectors of varying, you know, efficacy, if that's a word. I think that's a word, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
you know, and then they tried flak boats and all this kind of stuff, and most of which didn't work. They were sort of stopgap measures for what was really effective Allied developments. You know, they really...
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Dropped the ball, the Germans, in many ways.
What about the global nature of the war? I mean, we've been, you mentioned here that they were in the Caribbean, that they were in New Zealand. When did this kind of major global approach to the U-boat war come about?
Well, this is one of the premises of the book, really, because people think of U-boats, they think of the Battle of the Atlantic. And by Battle of the Atlantic, they think the Battle of the North Atlantic convoy route, routes between Britain and Canada and the United States. And that's fair to say that was like Dönitz's main sort of target, if you like. But as early as 1940, he pushed a couple of U-boats towards the Mediterranean, and there was one U-boat that entered the Mediterranean and actually made it back out again. That was the only U-boat of the war to return from service in the Mediterranean. All the other ones that went into the Med stayed there and were sunk or destroyed in port. He pushed boats down to West Africa, Freetown, which was a major merchant staging post for convoys coming up from South Africa. Of course, once the United States was in the war, he launched an attack on the American East Coast, which is famously known as Operation Paukenschlag. But this is like a perfect example of the reality of the U-boat war, because it, you know, Operation Drumbeat, Paukenschlag, you know, it's this major offensive on the US. You take it on the greatest industrial power there is, and you do it with six U-boats, you know. So you're not going to actually, you know, you'll frighten the hell out of them, and you will cause some havoc, there's no doubt about it. But, you know, you're not going to cripple the United States with an initial wave of six U-boats, which is whittled down to five by one aborting prematurely. But then, you know, there were attacks on Canada. The most successful attacks of the war were actually off West Africa, and the most successful single offensive of the war, concerted offensive by U-boats, was a small number of Type 9s in the Caribbean who were targeting the oil transport from Venezuela. And they were gathered around to Aruba and Trinidad and that kind of area. And that's actually where the greatest single successes by U-boats were. They went into the Indian Ocean. They made it as far as the Arabian Sea. once they were in the Indian Ocean, when they were hunting around South Africa and Madagascar, there were quite a lot of successful missions, but ultimately, you know, with British code breaking and British naval power, they were defeated there too. And most of the U-boats that ended up based in the Far East achieved very little for what was massive voyages. I mean, this is the other thing. A U-boat that sailed as far as the Indian Ocean, if it returned to France, you know, it would take 6 months out of that U-boat's life, if you like, because not only the voyage itself, which one of them was a record-breaking voyage of months at sea, but once they're back, the rest and recuperation of the crew, the maintenance and so on and so on. So it was a major commitment of very scarce resources, because he didn't have the U-boat numbers he wanted until 1943, by which time, in my opinion, Germany had already lost the war anyway, you know, so it was never going to work.
Yeah. The mention of the code, Enigma code, is interesting. For those of us who haven't heard about that, can you just talk a little bit about the German submarine code?
Well, the Enigma machine was used by all German armed forces. They all had their separate code nets. The Luftwaffe had their code net, the army, the Waffen-SS, so on and so on. And the Kriegsmarine had these Enigma codes. They looked like a typewriter. They're in a box. Very sophisticated coding machine. Brilliant invention. And the U-boats had their specific code net, you know, their style of encoding and sending messages. And in the beginning of the war, Polish code breakers had already made advances into the army and so on and so on, and certain elements of the Navy, but the U-boat code net was relatively secure. But part of the downfall was they also had they had various different keys. Like, there was one key that U-boats used when they're in home waters, when they're about to go in and out of port. Well, that was broken by the Allies, but the combat U-boats remained quite sort of secure. But in 1941, of course, not only had various parts of Enigma machines been captured from combat U-boats, but they captured an entire Enigma from U-110, and that was it, basically. Once the Enigma codes were read, because of the nature of how U-boats were deployed, it required a centralized control from Karl Dönitz in charge of the U-boat fleet. And he would allocate, you know, an area on a grid chart, a naval grid chart, where the U-boats would operate and all this kind of thing. And that required a lot of radio traffic and information. Once the Allies had actually broken that code, they knew exactly where the U-boats were. And they managed to not only reroute convoys around it, but they, you know, sometimes they targeted certain U-boats, like when they developed these refueling U-boats, which were crucial for long-distance missions. They targeted them, sank them all, and so on and so on. And the Germans had a mistaken belief that the Enigma was impenetrable, and it was a brilliant machine. I mean, it was a very, very clever piece of engineering, but it had been penetrated. The Battle of Al Alamein on land, it was, you know, helped enormously by the fact that Montgomery knew exactly what was going on the other side. I think the Germans, by and large, during the Second World War, you know, I think it's fair to say that in many ways, the Allies there's never been a war fought by someone that knows exactly what's going on the other side to such a degree as what the Allies had in the Second World War, which is hats off to, you know, the Polish cryptographers, but also Bletchley Park, who put the finishing touches on all this, and Alan Turing and people like that, which is a fascinating story in itself, you know.
The Germans didn't have any inkling that this was going on?
They did. They sort of, you know, people kept ringing alarm bells. Dönitz himself was sort of going, hang on a minute, you know, this is a bit odd. I mean, there was one example of three U-boats that met in an island in the middle of nowhere to sort of swap equipment and so on, and the British turn up. You know, a submarine turns that just happens to be there, and then it's like, well, what are the odds? You know, so, yeah. But they basically, there was an admiral in charge of ciphers, essentially, and he kept doing these investigations, and he operated on the principle that there's a certain amount of arrogance there. He just sort of thought, no, there's no way they could break it. So they operated from that standpoint rather than being devil's advocate and going, I think they've broken it. How could they have done this? You know, So it was misplaced sort of arrogance, if you like.
Yeah. And let's talk about the U-boats at the end of the war. I've got an order from Donitz here. Every enemy vessel which serves the landing, even if it ferries only 50 sailors or a tank, is a target demanding the total commitment of the boat. Oh. It is to be attacked even if one's own boat is put at risk. When it is a matter of getting at the enemy landing fleet, no thought must be given to the danger of shallow water or possible mine barriers or any other consideration. Every man and every weapon of the enemy destroyed before the landing reduces the enemy's chance of success. But the U-boat, which inflicts losses on the enemy at the landing, has fulfilled its highest task and justified its existence, even though it stays there. That's engaged. There's a lot going on there, isn't it?
Yeah, there's an awful lot going on there. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's quite an infamous episode in U-boat history, really, which people still argue about to this day. You know, people who weren't there, because essentially that was to counter the D-Day landings, Normandy in 1944, and Dönitz, you know, in that kind of fiery way that a lot of the German leaders, particularly Hitler, did. They demanded total commitment, total obedience, total this, that, and the other, and it was thought to inspire their troops. Where it went slightly wrong was it's been interpreted as an order to ram your U-boat into the enemy, and there's lots of differences of opinion about whether that was actually given as an order, because one U-boat commander called Herbert Werner, who wrote a fantastic autobiography called Iron Coffins, in it he relates that he was at a meeting of the first U-boat flotilla officers when their commander, Werner Winter, gave that order from Dönitz, and basically someone said to him, does that mean that we should, you know, if all else fails, we should ram the enemy? And he said yes. Now, I've spoken to a man called Hans Rudolf Rosing, who was what they call FDU West, and he was in charge of all the logistics of the Western U-boats based in France. And he used to go around these U-boat bases, and, you know, he looked after them when they were ashore. He didn't have operational control when they were at sea. That was handled by Dönitz. But he had a control over the repairs, you know, where they were stationed ashore and all this kind of thing. Very important guy in the U-boat chain of command. And I asked him, because he's often blamed for giving this order to ram U-boats, and he told me that at no point did they actually say ram your U-boats into the enemy, but they did say total commitment. They said, you know, you have to take chances, because basically the U-boats were being used as an anti-invasion measure for which they were completely unsuited. They were going to be outmatched by the enemy, and it turned out to be exactly that. A lot of U-boats, they left the French ports to attack the Normandy fleet and achieved absolutely nothing, except most of them were sunk. So it's a bit of a, you know, it's a bit of a gray area, that one. And as I say, people still argue about it, but, you know, from the horse's mouth, I got this kind of thing that Dönitz didn't believe in suicide missions. It was that kind of Third Reich rhetoric, you know, sort of complete commitment, backs to the wall, you know, last shell, last man, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary moment as well. And also this next one here, I thought this was a fantastic paragraph. This is from Dönitz himself. My U-boat men, 6 years of U-boat war lie behind us. You have fought like lions. A crushing material superiority has forced us into a narrow area, and continuation of our fight from the remaining bases is no longer possible. U-boat men, undefeated and spotless, you lay down your arms after a heroic battle without equal. We remember in deep respect our fallen comrades who have sealed with death their loyalty to the Führer and the Fatherland. Comrades, preserve your U-boat spirit with which you have fought courageously, stubbornly and imperturbably through the years for the good of the Fatherland. Long live Germany. Give us a bit of the context of what's going on here with this final message to the U-boat crew.
That's the end of the war, basically. That's when Dönitz gave the order to cease fire. And, you know, by this stage, he was no longer simply commander of the U-boat service. He was commander of the entire German Navy. And yeah, the war was lost. He actually concentrated a lot of resources in those last days to evacuating civilians and troops from from the east in the Baltic and all this kind of stuff. There was this was the tail end of a campaign he'd mounted inshore in British waters, where the U-boats were told to go close inland and operate using snorkel devices so they could remain submerged and attack British shipping in there, which was initially quite successful. It took the British by surprise. But again, it was never going to alter the balance of the war. The war was lost on land. In the air, it had been lost years before. And basically, he was ordering his troops to cease fire. And in his opinion, the Navy had never done anything to blemish its record in combat or anything like that, which is why naval records are so available. They were actually protected in a castle called Castle Tambach and handed over to the Allies intact, or virtually intact, because Dönitz considered that the Navy had nothing to hide, nothing to fear from the victors and so on and so on. So, yeah, that was his last sort of big message to his men. You know, nearly three quarters of the U-boat service were killed. And they continued to sail in obsolete machines. They knew they were, you know, their backs were truly against the wall, and their odds of survival were very slim. And yet they did continue to sail. And part of this is a legacy, a hangover from the First World War, where the revolution in the fleet actually kicked off, you know, a major mutiny at the end of the First World War, and he was determined this wouldn't happen in the Second. You know, the Navy would fight with honor and end with honor and all this kind of thing. So that's the context of that. Yeah, and of course at that stage he was also the head of Germany too, because Hitler was dead. So
yeah. He's an interesting character, and he lived until 1980.
Fascinating sort of guy. You know, a massive contradictions, like a lot of these people who, you know, by virtue of being such a high-ranking officer in the Third Reich, you know, there's mighty skeletons in them dark cupboards, you know. But at the same time, he was kind of revered by his men to a degree not often seen. Well, I don't think that's necessarily true, but he was definitely revered by his men. They called him the Lion, you know. And he made a big deal in the early days when he was in charge of the U-boats and not the Navy. You know, he'd be, if at all possible, he'd be present when U-boats came home. He would debrief officers personally, and he wanted that personal touch with his men, and it definitely paid off, you know.
Yeah. He seems to have sidestepped, you know, the hunting for people associated with Nazi Germany. He was released from prison in 1956, then retired and just lived in northwestern Germany.
Yeah, essentially, yeah. I mean, you know, it's such a complicated subject, isn't it? I mean, this kind of idea that, you know, he sort of put forward the idea he didn't know what was going on in concentration camps and so on and so on. You sort of think, well, it's not true. You know, Eric Topp actually asked him when he came out of prison, and apparently Dönitz broke down in tears. And you sort of think, you know, he was a guy who, I think it's fair to say he was a military man. He wasn't a political animal, but he was also, at the same time, he subordinated himself completely to the nation. And at that time, the nation, it was very, I think the word is autocratic, isn't it? It was Hitler. Hitler was the embodiment of the nation. And I remember both Eric Topp and another officer, Jürgen Ersten, who was a fascinating guy, U-boat officer, he told me that Hitler had the ability to make Dönitz feel, in his own words, like a little sausage. Like an insignificant man. He allowed him to swim in a soup of emotion and all this kind of thing. That's the way he put it. So he, you know, for example, when the July 20th plot, when people tried to kill Hitler, you know, Dönitz was one of the first people on the radio sort of going, these traitors, you know, we're going to root out these Jewish Bolshevik traitors and all this kind of stuff. Was he anti-Semitic? I don't really know. Probably to a degree that a lot of those guys were, just by virtue of the times. I'm not apologizing for the man, but
he was certainly unrepentant of what he did in the war, stood by it all, you know.
Yeah, I mean, he was actually found guilty of waging aggressive warfare, which is quite sort of weird, isn't it, at Nuremberg. And one of the men that appeared in his defense for his not only giving the infamous Laconia order, but for waging unrestricted warfare was actually Admiral Nimitz of the U.S. Navy. And he went in and he said, the minute we declared war on Japan, the minute Japan attacked us and we, then declared war, we waged unrestricted warfare. We went for it with our submarines and sank anything that we could find that was Japanese. So one of his staunch defenders in the Nuremberg trials was an American admiral, he sort of, the U-boats, they didn't have anything to apologize for, really. I don't think so anyway. I mean, it's a bold statement because I imagine a lot of merchant mariners would take issue with that, when you're talking about something like this and you're dealing with statistics and numbers and stuff, it's hard to imagine the horror of being in a ship that's torpedoed out of nowhere, Yeah. But that's war.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Larry, it's been fascinating talking to you, and thank you very much indeed for your time. And I hope you've inspired lots of people to find out more about the U-boat war.
Oh, thank you very much.
Thank you all so much for listening. Now, please don't just listen to the Mariner's Mirror podcast. Please also check out the Mariner's Mirror podcast YouTube channel, where you will find some truly magnificent new things to see, not least the quite brilliant new videos we've made filming the world's best ship models with the latest camera equipment. There's also some fantastic animation work to be seen there. Now, this podcast comes from both the Lloyd's Register Foundation and the Society for Nautical Research, so do please take the time to check out everything that both of those wonderful institutions have been up to. You can find the Lloyd's Register Foundation's History Centre and Archive at hec.lrfoundation.org.uk and the Society for Nautical Research at snr.org.uk, where you can join up to enjoy all of the numerous perks of membership, including 4 copies of the printed Mariner's Mirror Journal every year, online access to over a century's worth of maritime history scholarship, online seminars, and you can even come to dinner on board HMS Victory. Lucky you.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like wary of the police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.